D1, number 14A.
We come to truth, and what do we see here in regard to our practice? If we see that on the level of divine science, of oneness, there is just one truth, truth itself, one consciousness, really the self-consciousness of being, being, capital B, being conscious of itself in one view, all-inclusive conscious, then I begin to realize that that consciousness is the only consciousness that can demonstrate anything. That truth, capital T, as the one consciousness, is self-realization, is really self-demonstration. It is really that which knows itself as a whole. And that relieves me at that point of knowing what is the specific error about the case. On that level, because truth does not know error, therefore it can also not know a specific error. It only knows its own realm, its all-inclusive truth, one truth. And so in that state, I'm not looking out to see the specific error of a case, and therefore the specific truth for a case, but I know that truth is already awake and alive, conscious of its all-embracing facts. So here again, I'm relieved of the responsibility to demonstrate something. You know, as we say, oh, I must make that demonstration. I must. Who is the I? Who is the must? And what demonstration? And how do I know what demonstration I have to make? It's all wrong. The I is wrong because it's the personal I which says, my personal view, my personal I must. Therefore, I have the power in my personal limited mind that must do something and make that and that demonstration. Who has given us the right to say what is in God's plan and what we have to demonstrate? All three factors, the I and the must and the demonstration, have nothing to do with being itself. It's all my personal view of right and wrong. That's all there is. Self-justification, self-righteousness, that's all. The Pharisee in me. Here, I begin first to see that I don't have to make a demonstration. But that doesn't mean that I have to be a sluggard about the situation, that I have to close my eye to a situation. But it means much more, namely, that I have to see that the only truth there is being itself. That's the only I there is, being itself, the I am. And that I am says, I am truth, the whole truth. And that whole truth, as the I am, says, I realize myself. I demonstrate myself. Nobody else has the power to make a demonstration. And you will agree with me that that relieves us tremendously from that sense of having to make a demonstration. I must make that demonstration. I must make that demonstration. I must make that demonstration. And it gets worse and worse. Because you just get cramped, because you can't. Where do you want to take the power to do it? The only power is truth. And that truth is the self-realization of itself. It's self-expressed. The word we had, the self-existent, now we have the self-expressed. Let's take love. What is the sense of love here as the one love? How does it apply to my daily life, to my practice? If God is love and one love, then God is not loving. God is not loving. He's much more than that. He is love. If I feel he is loving, then I have a feel that he has a relationship to a human, to a mortal, to me. Here, he is the one love. I don't take a little sector out of the one being and apply it to me. Here, I live and move and have my being in God. You see, that's Christianity on the plane of divine science, the coexistence of God and man, where man is integrated into the one love, into the one love, and therefore there is just one love. Naturally, at Jesus' time, he couldn't teach the people divine science, and therefore he had to teach to love one another, to love his neighbors as yourself, even to love your enemies. But that is not the plane of divine science. On this plane of divine science, we really see love in its own perfection. Therefore, we don't have to really work out our perfection. Nor do we have, say, to work for protection. How could we work for protection in divine science? We just can't. Because to work for protection means that we are outside of the one all-embracing love. And we aren't. In the one love, we don't need protection. There isn't anything to be protected from. Because in divine science, you know, the accuser is not there. And if in divine science the accuser is not there, we don't need to work for protection. And we do much better to see that all is love. We don't need to love each other. We don't need to love on that plane. I'm getting on very tricky ground. Because afterwards they say, oh, that chap Max said, we don't have to love each other anymore. We just can go on hating each other. You see, it's so clear, so pure, that on that level where divine science has no accuser, we don't need to protect ourselves from an enemy, from a danger. What is a protection, humanly seen, is divinely seen, that where I see that love never loses sight of loveliness, that love is never without its object or manifestation. That's the fact about that relative proposition of protecting ourselves. Or we say, I must work out my place and my mission in the infinite plane. No. We don't have to work out our place in our niche of time, as Mrs. Eddy calls it, in divine science. In divine science, I am integrated into being. I have no being separate from the one being. There is only one life we have seen, not many lives. Therefore, in love, being is integrated into one being, and all there is that love is plain. And if I begin to see what that means, that love is that symbol for that reality in being which says there is an infinite telefinalistic or teleological plane where everything is coordinated towards a fulfillment, or where everything is already now coordinated and integrated into the best, highest form of completion, then I see that I'm already in the plane, and that there is no I in the plane, but there is just plane. Do you realize how important it is to drop that sense of I and you and we and he and she? Yes. If that is out, if I have no more a sense of I, then I don't ask anymore how find I my place in this universe, in the plane of being. There's no more an I, a personal I. When there is no more a personal I, then really I'm free to look into the immensity of being and see there is plane. And that plane has to do with ideas. And that plane is operating, because then in principle as love I see that that plane is operating as really the harmony of being. So also this sense here relieves us of that tremendous burden which we all perhaps have, that burden which says you have to achieve something. Love, not really understood properly, gives a sense of achieving a fulfillment, of achieving something. In love, we don't have to achieve anything. No one of us has to achieve anything in love. There is one love. That means there is in reality that nature which says that God is never without its object or manifestation, and therein there is nothing to be achieved. That takes us away the burden that we feel that we can't make the grade, that we are not good enough, that we have not enough faculties to do what we would like to do, that we have not enough opportunities to do what we like to achieve, that I have not been as successful as the other one, that therefore I am not as valuable as the other one, and so on, and so on, and so on. And we know how this sense of having to achieve something just drags us down all over the place. It's only because we have a personal sense of ourselves. If we would have left that out and see true individuality, and that true individuality is life as one infinite individuality, then we would see here in love that that true individuality is always fulfilled. Always fulfilled, and is just achieving its own purpose. Love is achieving what is destined for me to do. Not I have to achieve what is destined for me to achieve. Here in love, she always speaks of instantaneous healing, because it is that coincidence of God and man which is brought out in love. Love never without its object of manifestation. Therefore, it's instantaneous healing that is achieved. And it's quite interesting to look through the books, especially through old notes of Mrs. Eddy's students, and see how she dealt with instantaneous healings. Because I found, first of all, that always she would touch on it on the plane of divine science. That's the only plane where instantaneous healing can happen, because of that oneness, you see. Second, it is always at the point of Christianity or love. She brings in love or the allness. And then I found rather an interesting comparison with what we are thinking out now. I would like to read it just quickly to you from the notes students have taken on this subject. Note, she closed the college in 88 or 89, round about that time, and in one of those last classes which she gave, she was talking about instantaneous healing. And the student wrote down this. She says, Mrs. Eddy said, we also would use the old nets and the word or argument. But when we realize that God is all, you see, you come now to the level of divine science. If you lift your thought out of the argumentation to the level of divine science, we shall need no argument. The realization, and this is what's put in italics, the realization of the allness of God will be the physician for all error. Then will come instantaneous healing. So at that time, apparently she taught that the realization of the allness of God will bring instantaneous healing. And the students must have been very good, because they learned that lesson apparently over and over, because 10 years later, when Mrs. Eddy out of the blue called together 70 students for a class of 2 or 3 days in Concord, she was again asking this question. And Edward Norwood, who was in that class, made the following notes on that statement. He said, the second day, the leading question was, how would you heal the sick instantaneously? Then he goes on and says, the answer was to realize the presence of love. You see, practically the same thing as what they were being taught 10 years ago. And then he goes on and said how she asked various people and they all would answer in the same way, through the realization that God is all or that God is love. And he goes on and says, Mrs. Eddy listened patiently. Then she said, you have answered very well. Very well indeed. But always comes the but. But you don't get quite close enough. Now let me tell you how I would heal instantaneously. It is not so much to realize the presence of love, but love. Now this is the jump. This is going up higher to the level of divine science. To realize that God is all is a realization which we make. And it still has that human element within it. But love doesn't heal because we realize that love is all. No. For love is all in all. Love is completion. Love is fulfillment. It's just love. And I'm quite sure that many of you, perhaps I'll say all of us, have had those moments where we didn't have to realize that love is all. That we had a moment where we didn't have to think things out and reject the arguments and suggestions against the allness of God, but where we just had, I would say, the feeling of love. And we wouldn't perhaps not even be able to express what it exactly means. But it was a higher understanding than if we would have been able to explain it in so and so many words. Just to feel the atmosphere of love. Not only to realize love, to claim that there is only one love. See, this is all argumentation still. But if we go through the Word and Christ, we come from time to time to that wonderful touch where we just feel, understandingly feel, overwhelmingly clearly feel love. Because that's the fact of being. God doesn't realize that he is all in all. He doesn't realize that he's all in all. He is all in all. God doesn't have to think out why he is all in all and why there is nothing beside him. All that he doesn't. He just is all. And therefore he just is one life, one truth, and therefore one love. One solution. Well, these are the things which we begin to realize more and more and which somehow come to us in the quietude of consecration, in the quietude of listening with a pure metaphysical mind. Then the science of mind can break on thought. And then it teaches us what no book has taught us, what no teacher has taught us. And it teaches us with such conviction and with such certainty that we will never be tempted to waver in it, to disbelieve in it, or not to trust in it. And so it is with the last point of divine principle love. Here I begin to see for my daily life that I see all I see. In that one being and in that oneness of being there is an eternal dynamic, a divine principle, an eternal dynamic. This one life, this one truth, this one love is not just something static, but is an internal dynamic, an internal harmony of being. But that dynamic of being must have the touch of love, must have a purpose that is worthwhile. It can't be just that which we find in other sciences, that it has just a principle, but no overall plan. No overall design which is an eternal design, which is not blind to the future, which is not blind to the surrounding, which is not blind to its implication to the whole universe, which is not blind to the implication of the whole development of mankind and of the universe. Therefore, this principle is working out the ends of eternal good. And so I can trust absolutely that this consciousness which I have of the one life, the one truth, and the one love is a principle, is a self-operative eternal principle. But not only a self-operative eternal principle, but a principle which is love, which works out the ends of eternal good. It's therefore the unlabored motion, really, of perfect plan, of perfect design. Never in my life, as in the last few years, I have got such a trust in the idea. I don't trust God. God is passé. It's a mythical concept. And our age must come out of mythology. It hasn't come out of mythology because we have rockets and atom bombs and computers. Inside in us is an awful lot of mythology. And thank God to the psychologists and psychiatrists that they have found out how much all theology slumbers in each one of us. Terrific love. And because we are not, have not been conscious of it, not aware of it, this mythological concept could do with us just what it wanted to do with us. That was that unconscious, that subconscious layer in our being, which was just really defining our feelings, our character, our way of doing things and handling this and reacting to things. That's old mythology. It's not that which we have learned in school. In school we have just learned to calculate right, some geometry and some physics and so on, but no one has taught us life, the science of life. Our whole schooling is one-sided, and on the wrong side, mostly. It's just the intellectual side. And we'll see the time coming and the seeing that the other side will be taught in school, that man is being, and what that being is. And so, if I said I don't trust God, I meant I don't trust the old concept of a God, because it's the idea that works, and the idea is powerful, and the idea is always the idea of a divine principle. And we can be so sure that if we trust the idea, that it will do with us so many things which we don't like. An awful lot of things which we just don't like. And they are the best things that can be done to us. Because they force us to give up all that lingering subconscious and unconscious and bring us up to awakened consciousness, to spiritual consciousness. What is that spiritual consciousness? It is not our consciousness, it is the consciousness of being, the consciousness of the one life, the one truth, and the one love. And we can trust in that, if we open up ourselves to that will use us, live us, demonstrate us in the way that is working out something much bigger than what our human concept can ever figure out. And that's the bigness of it.